Chapter 4. Learn from Trail Lore. We descended Mount Greylock with plump, pancake-filled stomachs. We easily crossed the Berkshires Plateau of Massachusetts and entered Connecticut. Out of the 14 states on the AT, we ranked Connecticut dead last on the enjoyment scale. It's really not poor Connecticut's fault. We just happened to walk into the small state during one of the summer's most brutal heat waves. The temperatures were around 100 degrees and the humidity was over 90%. The conditions were incredibly debilitating as sweat poured down our backs. The only morons climbing mountains were thru-hikers. Day and weekend hikers wisely stayed in their air-conditioned homes. Unfortunately, the trail follows the low-lying Housatonic River, and the highest mountain in Connecticut, Bear Mountain near Salisbury, is a minuscule 2,316 feet. So there's no escaping the inferno. Add some mosquitoes to the mix, and you'll understand why Connecticut left a sour taste in our mouths. However, it was in Connecticut that we came across a man who had an unusual tale to tell, and his name was Party House. Of course, the first question we asked him was how he got a trail name like Party House. Party House explained that one June morning, he woke up and thought, "Gee, I need a physical challenge, something bold and exciting." Someone had told him of a 2,168-mile trail that crossed 14 states on the east coast of the U.S. and takes about 6 months of backpacking to complete. Party House, who had never hiked a day in his life, thought that such a challenge might fit the bill. Armed with a degree from a prestigious culinary school and zero hiking experience, he had no clue what it took to hike the whole trail. He had been a chef for several years, but now wanted to get some perspective and possibly make a career change. Although he had never backpacked in his life, he understood that he wouldn't be able to whip up 5-star menus on the Appalachian Trail. Mac and cheese is about as fancy as it gets out there. His girlfriend drove him from Boston to the northern tip of the AT near Bangor, Maine. He walked into the only outfitter in town, declared that he wanted to hike the AT, and that he needed help purchasing the necessary equipment since he had absolutely nothing, not even a pair of hiking shoes. The salesman's eyes lit up, and in an hour or two, he had helped him purchase hundreds of dollars worth of gear. After loading up the shopping cart, the only item that was left to buy was a shelter. Most AT hikers start with a small, light, 4 to 5 pound tent, and then some switch to a 1 pound tarp during the journey as they realize that tents are overrated and too heavy for a thru-hike. Party House was dimly aware that he should minimize the weight he carried, so he asked the salesman to give him the smallest and lightest tent they had. The salesman replied, "I'm sorry, but we're a small outfitter, and we don't have a wide selection. The best thing I can get you is a 9-pound, 3-person tent." Without any other easy alternative, and not fully realizing how quickly 9 pounds can feel like 50, Party House said, "I'll take it." It didn't take long for another thru-hiker to see Party House's massive dome tent. The thru-hiker, dumbfounded by the one-person palace, declared, "With the powers vested in me as a fellow thru-hiker, I hereby name you Party House." The name stuck, and the lesson of Party House stuck in my mind, too. Learn from trail lore.
The lightest pack on the trail. Thru-hikers can be so obsessed with shaving every ounce of weight that they will clip the handles of their toothbrushes and trim the edges of their maps. In Massachusetts, for example, we ran into Beat, a thru-hiker who took going light to a new level. Beat had some time off before he was going to Africa for the Peace Corps. Hiking the AT would be a great adventure before venturing into the bush. Beat got his trail name because he was always tired, or Beat. So after hiking over 500 miles, Beat ditched his 60-pound pack and bought a fanny pack and a compact, lightweight hammock, which he wrapped around his waist. Inside his diminutive fanny pack were rain pants, iodine tablets, a few energy bars, and bagels. With the water bottle strapped to his side and a camera around his neck, he was carrying a paltry 6 pounds. Most thru-hikers thought he was insane, yet Beat managed to hike several hundred miles of the trail in this way. The nights were so hot and humid in the mid-Atlantic states that he really didn't need a sleeping bag, so Beat just slept in his rain pants when he was cold. Of course, the first cold spell in the highlands of Virginia made him quickly realize that his days of featherweight backpacking were over. Autumn was coming.
There's a French proverb that says, "If the young only knew, if the old only could." It amazed me how many people were attempting to thru-hike the AT and had done little to no research on what they were about to do. Every spring, thousands of prospective thru-hikers ascend Springer Mountain in Georgia, the southern terminus of the AT, hopefully thinking that they will hike all the way to Maine. However, a whopping 15% quit at Neal's Gap, a mere 30 miles into their journey. About 70% drop out before the halfway point, Harper's Ferry. Fewer than 20% actually complete the entire trail. Moreover, the vast majority of thru-hikers make major changes in their gear within the first couple of weeks. What accounts for these dismal statistics? It is what happens when people don't learn from trail lore. This chapter will explain the importance of the fourth principle. It is hard to get the most out of life when you spend the majority of your time unnecessarily suffering from errors that you could have easily avoided. Some of these mistakes are meaningless, but others can devastate your life. To squeeze the most out of life, we need to learn from the experience of others. By building on this experience, not only can we make progress as individuals, but also as a society. Trail Lore Quiz. Let's see how well you learn from trail lore. Don't worry, I won't ask you who was the first person to thru-hike the AT. But I will ask you 5 questions. Add up your totals at the end, and you'll see how you did. First question. Before you accept a job at a company, do you usually research it thoroughly? Rate yourself on a 1 to 10 scale. Give yourself a 10 if you do meticulous research. Give yourself a 1 if you go with your gut 100% of the time. Second question. Before going to the movies, do you read reviews? Give yourself a 10 if I read so many that I know more about the movie than most people who have seen it. Or give yourself a 1, I rarely see the trailer. Question 3. How much planning and research do you do before going on a major vacation? Give yourself a 10 if you say, I could be a professional tour guide by the time I arrive. Give yourself a 1 if I go there blindly. Question 4. When you job search, how much do you consider the advancement possibilities and the day-to-day lives of the people in those positions? Give yourself a 10 if you can say, I can tell you exactly what the possibilities are and what life is like for each position. Give yourself a 1 if you have no clue where this job may lead you. The 5th and final question. When you consider buying or renting a home or an apartment, how much research do you do? Give yourself a 10 if you could say, I teach the realtors lessons. Or give yourself a 1 is, I grab the first thing that feels good. Okay, now let's add up your scores. If you scored less than 30, then you need to learn more from trail lore before you make important decisions in life. If you scored 31 to 45 points, then you should keep learning from trail lore like you've been doing. If you scored 46 to 50, then you might want to relax a little bit. As we'll see later, you don't want to overdose on planning. By the way, in case you're wondering who the first person to thru-hike the AT was, it was in 1948, Earl Schaefer, the crazy one, as he called himself. And by the way, he did it for a third and final time in 1998, when he was almost 80 years old.
Night hiking. I enjoy night hiking, even though you miss out on most of the scenery. It's not only romantic to hike by the light of the moon, but your mind also runs wild whenever it hears the strange sounds in the bushes. You feel like death lurks in every shadow. It's thrilling, in a strange way. Given the heat in Connecticut, we decided to try night hiking, hoping the slightly cooler temperatures would let us travel more efficiently. Bad move. By 10 p.m., my tiny flashlight was fading. With no place to camp, we slept in the middle of the trail. It was such a hot and humid night that we didn't even bring out our sleeping bag. We hadn't seen many bugs since Maine, so we were caught off guard when they came out in force in Connecticut. For 1 hour, I stared at the stars and endured the high-pitched squeal of mosquitoes. And then finally...
Have you slept at all?
No, I replied.
How about we hike some more?
Okay. So from midnight to 5 a.m., we hiked, taking occasional breaks to sleep. Within a few minutes, the mosquitoes would find us and wake us up with their bites. The humidity and the heat was still atrocious at 2 a.m. At 5 a.m., we cooked up a meal. We kept hiking until 8 a.m., where we collapsed on the side of the trail. We slept without any pads on the hard rock. By 10 a.m., we woke up and kept going. The sad thing is that instead of walking 15 miles that night, we had hardly done 5 miles, because we had only one flashlight that had a dying battery. We were hiking using the pale moonlight that filtered through the trees, and I don't have great night vision. In short, our hope to hike more efficiently in the cooler temperatures was a complete disaster.
What makes humans special? We were thrilled to leave Connecticut behind, especially because New York was next. The August temperatures were blazing in the high 90s, and the next day was supposed to soar past 100 degrees. It was so muggy that we would sweat profusely while we were sleeping and had to pour water over our heads during the night to keep cool. Trying to hike up a mountain was like trying to do a 2-hour step aerobics class in a steam shower. We happily escaped the inferno by taking the Harlem line of the Metro North Railway right into Grand Central Station in Manhattan. This brisk train ride transported us from the woods to the center of civilization. We stayed with a business school friend whose apartment had air conditioning, a glorious invention. I was overwhelmed. My senses, now heightened from 6 weeks of backpacking, were overloaded. For weeks, I'd grown hypersensitive to the subtle crack of a twig, the gentle song of a bird, the refreshing smell of rain, and the soft colors of sunrise. Now, I was assaulted by the cries of sirens, the screeching of subways, the flashing neon lights of Times Square, and the din of millions of people. However, it was thrilling. This was the ultimate one-time upgrade. Lisa enjoyed wearing heels, putting on makeup, and feeling like a girl again. I simply enjoyed traveling 30 miles per hour in a taxi. We ate like royalty. We dined at the famous Union Square Cafe, had Tibetan food, gelato, New York bagels, and of course, pretzels from the charming street vendors. We went to a couple of museums, Broadway shows, and monuments. We did things we could never do on the trail, like being able to get Ben and Jerry's ice cream at 2 o'clock in the morning and sleep in a soft bed. As I lay in bed, I thought about what we had been doing just a few days before on the AT. Then the TV weatherman came on and reported the record-breaking temperatures. He advised citizens to avoid strenuous activity. I chuckled and mumbled, "That's the understatement of the week." Then I rolled over, turned the AC up a notch, and drifted off to sleep with a big smile on my face. I was savoring Manhattan and admittedly somewhat reluctant to jump back on the trail, knowing that it had not cooled down that much. Nevertheless, we could not wait forever, or else winter would set in before we finished the trail. I knew that August would be a hot and challenging month. No one ever said it would be easy weather the whole way. Before we left, we went into the World Trade Center to feel the aura of New York one last time, not knowing that just 1 month later, it would no longer be standing. Alexis de Tocqueville said, "History is a gallery of pictures in which there are few originals and many copies." My pit stop in Manhattan had rejuvenated my spirits, and I quickly relished being on the trail again. We zipped through New Jersey's 72 miles and were eager to tackle the 230 miles of extremely rocky trail ahead of us in Pennsylvania, or as I like to call it, Roxylvania. When I wasn't watching my step, I scanned for wildlife. But through hiking isn't a great way to see animals because they run away before you see them. The best way to see them is to stay put for several hours. But thru-hikers are almost always moving. Therefore, the only bear we saw on the trail was in New Jersey. It was rather small and hid from us. We saw moose in Maine and Vermont. We saw many birds, squirrels, deers, bats, frogs, lizards, salamanders, and snakes. With the thought of wildlife and New York juxtaposed in my mind, I wondered, what makes humans so special? Why are we able to construct such vast metropolises? Why don't the squirrels dominate this planet? Why aren't blue jays constructing skyscrapers, subways, and air-to-ground missiles? It made me also think about Homer Simpson, who said, "Weaseling out of things is important to learn. It's what separates us from the animals, except the weasel." Clearly, our ability to communicate sophisticated concepts coupled with our amazing capacity to learn has allowed our species to excel. One of the reasons we have done so well is that we are able to quickly pass an enormous amount of information on to our children. Of course, other animals are also capable of learning. After all, many animals can teach their offspring how to fly, how to create a shelter, or how to act cute and beg those silly humans for food. However, animals are incapable of transmitting and remembering the massive amount of information that we humans are able to. Our brain's ability to communicate and assimilate petabytes of data is one of the reasons we're so special. It's a shame when we don't take advantage of it, because when we do, we can get the most out of life. Immanuel Kant said, "But though all our knowledge begins with experience, it does not follow that it all arises from experience." What the brilliant philosopher Immanuel Kant was trying to say was that not all of our knowledge must come from our personal experience. Indeed, the more we leverage the experience of others, the better off we will be. That's the key lesson in learning from trail lore. Those who are not getting the most out of life are usually only learning from their own experience and ignore the experience of others. What would happen if all humans did this? We would still be living in caves, hiding from our predators, and wondering how we can take over the world. Gee, that sounds like a bunch of Al-Qaeda terrorists, but never mind. The point is that our rapid progress, both as a species and as individuals, is tightly correlated to how much we learn from others. Think about what you're good at and ask yourself if you could ever be that good without having learned from the knowledge and experience of others. For example, a bench warmer on a professional sports team today would have been one of the top players of the league just 50 years ago. That athlete has learned from all the moves, training, and techniques of the previous athletes. Astronomers today are discovering new planets because they're building on all the accumulated human knowledge of the stars. Even the art of making some mouth-watering French bread has been passed down for generations. Therefore, to live our lives to the fullest, we shouldn't start from the basement. We should start from the highest floor possible. The only way to do that is to diligently study those we would like to emulate and see what they did to get there. Our ability to learn from trail lore is one of our competitive advantages as a species, so let's use it. No matter what passion you pursue, learn from the accumulated knowledge out there. For example, if you want to be the best mother in the world, then read all the latest books on parenting and see what works. Don't just trust one source. Read multiple opinions to help you get diverse viewpoints and experiences. Your mind will assimilate this knowledge and formulate a solid plan to accomplish your goals. You will diminish the number of missteps and counterproductive actions. Hegel once said, "We learn from history that we do not learn from history." When we study history, we see that people repeat the same errors. Indeed, it's impossible to live life without repeating the same silly mistakes that humanity has done over and over again. George Satayana said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." But some may question why making a misstep is such a big deal. I questioned that myself as I slipped and nearly broke my ankle on the millionth rock I walked on in Pennsylvania. The cost of missteps. The cost of missteps can vary from the annoying to the life-threatening. After getting through Pennsylvania, we entered Maryland and met a thru-hiker who experienced an annoying mistake because he mistimed his box shipments with his hiking pace. Some towns along the trail are so remote that they have a post office but no supermarket. Before their hike, many thru-hikers use guidebooks to identify stretches of trail without easy access to a supermarket. For those areas, they prepare a resupply box filled with dry food, band-aids, and other valuable items. Before our AT hike, for example, we prepared a dozen resupply boxes. My wonderfully supportive mother in California would faithfully take each box to the post office about 2 weeks before I needed it and shipped it across the country. This system worked well unless the thru-hiker arrived at the post office on a Saturday afternoon. Most post offices would close around noon on Saturday and would not open again until Monday morning. Therefore, for those thru-hikers who were trying to keep a certain pace, and most were, it was annoying to arrive at the post office on Saturday afternoon because you would be forced to stay there until Monday morning when the post office reopened. I met a thru-hiker who mistimed his pace so that for 3 weeks in a row he arrived at the post office on a Saturday afternoon. He was frustrated. He needed to either hike faster or slower, but the stubborn man didn't adapt or learn. Sadly, he's not the only man with this shortcoming. Of course, some people welcome the 42-hour break, but he did not because he would get into a hiking groove and did not want to lose momentum. Moreover, sometimes a day and a half off did more harm than good. Your muscles would tighten up, and making them move again was excruciatingly painful. He wanted to keep a rhythm. Because this thru-hiker did not learn from the trail lore of previous hikers, or even his own lore, he continued to make the same aggravating mistake over and over again. This decreased his enjoyment of the hike, yet he could have easily avoided it had he just learned from trail lore or listened to his wife. John Gardner said, "History never looks like history when you are living through it.
Double stuff. One gray, soggy morning in Maine, we groggily woke up to the realization that we had no fuel or matches. Despite all our planning and learning from trail lore, we had accidentally not brought enough fuel for the first leg of our journey. Unfortunately, the only food we had left needed to be cooked. The wet woods surrounding us extinguished any hope that we'd be able to spark up a fire like our ancestors. Instead, we resigned ourselves to eating cold, uncooked oatmeal. This disgusting, pasty gruel was about as appetizing as eating a soggy newspaper. Shortly after hitting the trail and listening to my stomach complain as it tried to digest the raw oatmeal, I smelled something delicious. Bacon. Francis and I both noticed the saliva seeping out of each other's mouths. Close by was a man merrily cooking in the wilderness. He had countless clothes strewn about drying on trees. His accommodations were extravagant. One tent for himself and a palatial tarp for his cooking area. His kitchen was grandiose. Pots, pans, and utensils everywhere. The aromas emanating from his gourmet cooking were intoxicating. "What's your name?" I asked, trying not to stare at his food.
"Double Stuff."
"How did you get that name?" I wondered, suddenly fantasizing about his massive stash of Oreos Double Stuff cookies that he must have had in his enormous backpack.
"They call me Double Stuff because I carry about double the stuff that most thru-hikers carry. Most thru-hikers carry about 35 pounds of gear, but I carry about 70. I'd rather section hike, EAT, and camp in comfort."
We nodded and gave him a strained smile. He cheerfully smiled back, and we grabbed a last whiff of his cuisine, dreaming of Oreo Double Stuff cookies as we miserably cranked out another 25 miles. I have never forgotten fuel since then.
Some missteps are not simply annoying, they're life-threatening. On the wall of the bookstore at Pinkham Notch Ranger Station was a massive list of all the people who had died in the presidential range in New Hampshire. The list described how and where each person died. Many perished in Tuckerman's Ravine. Clearly, some were not learning from the past catastrophes in this dangerous ravine. How many of these deaths could have been prevented had these people learned from trail lore? Although most of these deaths occurred in the brutal winter, some occurred in the middle of summer. By doing just a little bit of research, one can learn how fast the weather can change in the Presidential Mountain Range, and that it can even snow in July. Moreover, because of the infamous winds and unpredictable rainstorms, it doesn't have to get below 50 degrees for someone to die of hypothermia, the number one killer of backpackers. The wind chill robs you of your warmth, and if you set off, like this one doomed hiker did, in just shorts and a t-shirt, you are asking for trouble. I stared at the wall in dismay and saw how some had repeatedly made the same mistakes. In conclusion, mistakes can certainly be costly. They can be massive inflection points that send your life into a tailspin. The trick is learning how to avoid the costly ones. Backpacking versus thru-hiking. Let's see how to apply the learn from trail lore principle when hiking the AT. Imagine kissing your job and your friends goodbye to hike the AT over 6 months, and then you quit hiking the trail in just 2 days. As crazy as it sounds, this happens to hundreds of people every season as they are surprised by the reality of a thru-hike. Over 20% of wannabe thru-hikers quit within the first week. Had they just done some research on it, or gone out one weekend and walked 10 to 30 miles a day over mountains, they would have realized that they weren't up for the task. Instead, they relied on their limited backpacking experience, their gut instinct, or Uncle Harry, who supposedly knows everything. As all those who attempt thru-hiking the AT quickly learn, there is a big difference between backpacking and thru-hiking. That explains why a whopping 50% quit within the first 6 weeks of a thru-hike that normally takes 6 months. For example, compared to a successful thru-hiker, the typical backpacker brings far more items and far heavier items. Let's look at what a typical backpacker brings on a weekend hike or a week-long trip. The typical backpacker will bring heavy pots and pans to make gourmet meals. The thru-hiker will bring one ultralight titanium pot. The typical backpacker will bring fresh clothes for each day outside. The typical thru-hiker will bring no extra clothes except for maybe an extra pair of underwear and socks. The typical backpacker brings a large, comfortable tent versus a thru-hiker just brings a tarp. A typical backpacker will bring a full-length, deluxe, inflatable mattress. A thru-hiker will bring a thin foam pad. The average backpacker will bring a heavy-duty sleeping bag versus the average thru-hiker will bring a light sleeping bag and if it's cold, will simply sleep in their clothes. The standard backpacker will bring a giant expedition-sized backpack versus a thru-hiker will bring a small, lightweight backpack. An average backpacker will have camp shoes and a lightweight chair. A thru-hiker won't carry either of those things. And finally, a backpacker will probably bring a radio versus a thru-hiker will just listen to nature. Bringing a sleeping bag that is 1 pound lighter than the typical sleeping bag may not seem like much, but the differences begin to add up. Even little items, such as taking a minuscule knife versus a heavy Swiss Army knife, can have an impact if you do it across the board. Indeed, if you consistently find an item that weighs 25 to 50% less than the typical version of that item, then your pack weight will decline 25 to 50%. As obvious as that sounds, most of those who plan a thru-hike don't think about this, nor do they heed the lesson of those who had hiked before them. Instead, hikers look at their heavy-duty compass and think, "What's the big deal? It's only an ounce or two heavier." On the other hand, a prepared thru-hiker will search for a lightweight and accurate compass. In my case, for example, the compass was integrated in my watch. In fact, the AT is so well marked that you could even leave the compass at home. Besides, carrying a compass does not guarantee that you will not get lost. I managed to get lost on the AT even with signs all around me. The paradox of backpacking is that the more distance you walk, the less you should carry. This is counterintuitive, and so the best way to learn this lesson is through the experience of others. Most people assume that if they're going to embark on a 6-month expedition, they should take a ton of gear to prepare for all the possible challenges. However, trail lore teaches us the exact opposite. The longer the backpacking trip, the less you should carry. It's better to carry a light pack and resupply every 4 days or so. It's nearly impossible to walk over 2,000 miles in less than 6 months with 90 pounds on your back. If the simple exhaustion won't do you in, the inevitable injuries will. Since it's almost unbearable to carry more than 10 days of food, a long-distance backpacker must resupply along the way. If you don't believe me, just go to the supermarket, buy 10 days of food, put it all in a backpack, and try to make it back to your car without collapsing. Therefore, thru-hikers either hitchhike into a town that has a supermarket or ship food to a remote post office or hostel. They usually don't carry more than 6 days of food with them at any point during the journey. Why? Because the less they carry, the more miles they can walk. So the smart thru-hiker carries the bare minimum to be safe and walks 10 to 30 miles a day so that he avoids backpacking in the winter, which requires far more gear and is more dangerous than hiking during the other three seasons. The weekend backpacker, on the other hand, is in no rush and can afford to carry the kitchen sink because he's usually not walking very far. The casual backpacker loves having the pancake griddle and the comfy chair in the middle of nowhere. He walks 5 miles, sets up camp, and enjoys relaxing with his espresso. Although that is great fun, it can cloud your ability to understand the backpacking paradox that one should carry less the more one travels. We can learn about this paradox either 1. From personal experience, or 2. From trail lore. Because this lesson is so counterintuitive, even the avid weekend backpacker is usually poorly prepared for a thru-hike because he is burdened with preconceived notions of what thru-hiking must be like. And by the way, he can't imagine just how many rocks litter the trails of Pennsylvania.
PUD. Here's another difference between backpackers and thru-hikers. A typical backpacker doesn't really mind getting to the top of a mountain and discovering that there's nothing noteworthy to see. Who cares if the trees block the view, or that there's no cool plaque or pizza stand on the summit? The backpacker is happy to get some exercise and breathe the fresh air. Thru-hikers, on the other hand, may throw a fit. They believe that if there's nothing to see on the summit, the trail should take the low road around the mountain. They hate such uninspiring trails so much that they have an acronym for it, PUD, a pointless up and down. It's hard to imagine how frustrating it can be to climb endless PUDs. By the end of the day, you'll usually find thru-hikers making a little voodoo doll of the trail designer and poking him cruelly with a sharp stick.
Arnold Toynbee said, "History not used is nothing. And if you don't use the stuff, well, it might as well be dead." Before I backpacked, I talked to those who had. One guy told me how he would hike 10 miles a day and carry 70 pounds. This same guy would later tell me about his chronic back problems. I intuitively knew that carrying that much weight all day must be highly stressful on the body. Moreover, I knew I could walk more than 10 miles a day if I had nothing on my back. Therefore, instead of getting an expedition pack, I examined the day packs. These packs were not much bigger than your average school backpack. Getting a small backpack was a great way to discipline myself. With so little storage space, I had no other choice but to get rid of unnecessary items and to find lighter versions of the necessary ones. Hundreds of people have completed the AT, and a few have written books about what you should bring and how to minimize your pack's weight. Nevertheless, every season, over half the hikers repeat the same errors of the previous year's hikers. For example, when we started in Maine, nearly everyone we saw had these gigantic 50-pound packs. By the end of the journey, nearly everyone had trimmed down their packs to half their starting size. To do this, thru-hikers frequently abandon hundreds of dollars of gear, buy hundreds of dollars of new gear, and get back on the trail again. It's thanks to these discards that Cheapo, whom we met in Chapter 2, was able to hike from Georgia to New York on $20. He didn't have any gear, but he picked up most of it from the cast-offs of hikers before him. He acquired almost all the gear he needed in just the first 30 miles. When I talked with thru-hikers, they all wish that they had minimized their pack weight from the start. In other words, they all wished that they had learned from trail lore. This lesson applies to life off the trail, too. The goal is to learn from other people's experience so that your experience is the best it can be.
Trail lore from a 3-time AT thru-hiker. I enjoyed meeting Spur at the Upper Goose Pond Shelter in Massachusetts. He had thru-hiked the AT 3 times and had a wealth of wisdom. I asked him what he had learned from trail lore. He wrote,
"Walk yourself into shape gradually. Don't try to accomplish too much too fast. Your body will toughen and grow stronger. So will your confidence. Stay in touch with your body. Learn to recognize and respect its limitations even as you stretch and exercise it to become stronger. Lighten your load.
Learn to live with less stuff, and your life and your hike will be considerably less burdensome. Start the day early. The world never is more interesting than it is at dawn, especially in the woods. By noon, you'll already have accomplished a pretty good day's work. Don't be in too big of a hurry to finish. There's so much to savor along the way. Conversely, maintain your momentum. Don't allow yourself to get stuck by all the potential distractions. Good luck, Spur.
How to follow this principle. Following this principle doesn't just apply to thru-hiking. Indeed, you can benefit from it whether you are a father, a factory worker, or a rock star. Let's go through the 5 steps of how to learn from trail lore. Step 1. Clearing your mind of assumptions. It's hard to learn from trail lore if you have a closed mind. I asked one backpacker, "Why do you carry such a heavy pack?" He replied, "Because that's the way I've always backpacked. That's how my dad taught me." This backpacker might have trouble learning from trail lore because he assumes that there was only one way to backpack, and he can't fathom any other way of doing it. Therefore, step 1 is to clear your mind of assumptions. Otherwise, you will not consider all the possibilities. Step 2. Research meticulously. The more important the decision, the more you should research it. Yes, listening to your gut instinct is important. After all, there's a reason why your instincts are frequently correct. Our senses pick up subtle signs that may be difficult to explain, but they often signal the best way to go. As Steven Pinker points out in his brilliant book, How the Mind Works, these senses are tuned through millions of years of evolution, and ignoring them is often a bad idea. Nevertheless, our instinct is not always right, and it is often wrong when deciding something that is more cerebral than emotional. So what helps us make a good decision? Relevant information and lots of it. Can you imagine if we got all our history from just one source? After World War I, for example, Germany's history books depicted their country as a victim, not as an aggressor. Some students of that era made decisions based on one erroneous source. Similarly, people who decide to hike the AT after only talking with one hiker may be ill-prepared. Instead, read a few books on whatever subject you're about to engage in. Read magazines that take different points of view, and talk with a variety of people, especially those who have substantial experience on the matter. By sampling a broad spectrum, you can synthesize the best lessons from trail lore. Step 3. Periodically question your assumptions again. The world and technology is not static. Trail lore does not always reveal the right answer. Don't be afraid to ask such seemingly silly questions such as, "Is using a cellular phone without a headset unsafe?" Listen to someone who has an argument to claim that point. Keep your mind open and consider the idea, no matter how ludicrous it may sound. Copernicus had a crazy idea that the Earth revolved around the Sun. This idea was so sacrilegious that he didn't reveal his theory until he was on his deathbed. He feared getting killed for arguing such a point. Bruno, another famous astronomer around the same period, was burned at the stake for espousing similar views. Luckily, nowadays, we can ask wacky questions and make silly statements without getting flogged. In summary, we must question and re-question our beliefs and assumptions in order to keep learning from trail lore, especially recent trail lore. Step 4. Plot your path. Once you've learned from trail lore, you're ready to apply what you learned. For example, when I would plan my 4-day backpacking trips, I knew my destination, but I had to figure out how to get there. Similarly, after reading chapter 3, you might know where you want to end up, but you're not sure how to get there. That's when you should leverage the knowledge of previous hikers. Before starting a hike, I would learn the location of the mountains, the springs, the bridges, the trail junctures, and the shelters. Likewise, you should study the common shortcuts, pitfalls, and milestones that those who have gone before you have discovered. By doing that, you'll be taking the most enjoyable path to your destination. Finally, step 5, create trail lore. Let's say you've learned from trail lore and you've plotted your path. Now comes the fun part, creating trail lore. In New England, I heard about the legendary Barefoot Sisters who did just that. The year before, Isis and Jackrabbit, two sisters, thru-hiked most of the AT barefoot. They walked an amazing 1,300 miles barefoot and used sandals for the other 868 miles. They weren't able to go the whole distance barefoot because it's hard to walk over 10 miles a day without foot protection. So as they slowly headed south, winter caught up to them in Virginia. The icy ground sliced their bare feet into a bloody mess. This forced the hardy Barefoot Sisters to slap on shoes. With the determination of a bull, they made it to Georgia despite hundreds of miles of freezing temperatures. But their tale doesn't end there. They rested a couple of months in Georgia, slung on their backpacks, and then hiked right back up to Maine. This is what thru-hikers call a yo-yo hike. Like a yo-yo, the hiker hits her destination, turns around, and walks back to where she started. A yo-yo hiker can make a proud thru-hiker feel kind of wimpy. Toss in the fact that the sisters walked most of their yo-yo hike barefoot, and even macho men start feeling pretty puny. After hearing about the Barefoot Sisters, I was lucky to run into them at the Upper Goose Pond Cabin in Massachusetts. The rain and the all-you-can-eat pancakes for $3 drew over 40 thru-hikers into this bare-bones, off-the-trail cabin. As a Sobo, it was rare to see so many thru-hikers in one place, but New England is where the Sobos and Nobos converge. Sadly, Jackrabbit was feeling lethargic because she had contracted Lyme disease from a tick. She had a fever, muscle pains, a stiff neck, and inflamed joints. This forced her to hike in sandals. Although it was obvious how much she was suffering, she still had that fire in her eyes that told you, without a doubt, that she was going to Maine. I asked Isis, "Why do you and Jackrabbit hike barefoot?" She replied,
"Imagine if you wore gloves all day long for most of your life," she explained. "Then one day you took them off. Imagine how incredible that would feel. That's how it is for us. We truly feel the trail."
The Barefoot Sisters certainly hiked their own hike. Although they had learned from other barefoot hikers, they were venturing into unknown territory. Nobody had done this before. They were creating trail lore. The lesson of the Barefoot Sisters is clear. You can't spend all your life learning from trail lore. At some point, you should summon the courage to create some. I'm not saying that you should do something as monumental as a barefoot yo-yo thru-hike, but once you plot your path, walk it. Learning from trail lore can help you throughout your life. It can help you get into a good university, find your ideal job, make lucrative investments, attract your soulmate, and even avoid an untimely death. Clearly, it's a lesson that can be applied throughout life, not just in backpacking.
The terrible ticks. It's hard to avoid ticks when you backpack 2,000 miles. These tiny parasitic arachnids lie in the vegetation and latch onto you when you brush by. They can spend several hours crawling all over your body before finding a nice juicy spot to burrow into. I've caught a few on me, and I've always marveled at how you can't feel them, even when they're digging into your skin to feed off your blood. If you don't pluck them out of your body within 36 hours, then you risk contracting a disease. Therefore, smart hikers inspect their bodies at least once a day to see if any ticks have moved in without paying the rent.
Conquer your fears by learning from trail lore. Even after plotting your path, it's hard to summon the courage to walk it. However, one of the big benefits of learning from trail lore is that you learn to overcome your fears. Think about all the things you would do if you had no fear. Probably the number one thing you would do is pursue your passion. You might also skydive without a parachute, but I suppose that's when fearlessness becomes stupidity. Many of us don't pursue our passions because we're afraid of the unknown. By learning from trail lore, the unknown becomes known. You shed light on the subjects that were dark and mysterious. By understanding the risks and how others overcame them, you will feel more confident taking risks. Your research will help you conquer your fears and let you do what you love. When you plot your path based on trail lore, you can walk boldly down that path. Fear paralyzes us and impedes us from squeezing the most out of life. Learning from trail lore will let you crush your fears and take intelligent risks. George S. Patton, the U.S. Army general, said, "Take calculated risks. This is quite different from being rash." Although it's a lifelong dream for many, most don't hike the AT because of fear. Hundreds have told me, "I've always wanted to do that. Well, someday I will." I would see those who are in their 60s attempting it because they've postponed it all their lives. And those were the brave 60-year-olds. Most 60-year-olds are still not hiking it because of fear of injury, fear of not completing it, or fear of financial difficulties. Learning from trail lore teaches you that there are ways to minimize or eliminate all these fears so that you can complete your lifelong dreams today and not postpone them forever. Zokwaki, who was an AT Sobo, he wrote in his journal, "I used to love playing all sports, but as I've gotten older, I enjoy the outdoors more than anything. For this, I thank my wife. I enjoy playing golf, especially with my father-in-law, Roy. Most of all, I enjoy my wife and dogs. To me, hiking the Appalachian Trail is our first step in starting a simpler life. I have always said that it is a shame to work every day for 65 years in hopes of retirement when one can enjoy life. I want to do all that I can while I'm young enough and my health is still good. Our plans after the trail are to move back to Wisconsin near our families, buy some land, and live together a bit simpler. I'm doing this hike for my best friend, my wife. The only time I'm truly happy is when I'm with her." It's becoming clear how the principles that I learned on my odyssey interrelate. Following the fourth principle, like following the second principle, helps you follow the third principle. In other words, it's tough to pursue your passion, the third principle, if you're financially handicapped, afraid, or not sure how to pursue it. Thus, the second and fourth principles show you how to live below your means and learn from others. Respecting these principles lets you truly hike your own hike and enjoy life to the fullest. Although you can follow one of these principles and ignore the others, you create a virtuous cycle when you follow all of them concurrently. Common criticisms. I had plenty of time to question the fourth principle during the mild mid-Atlantic states and come up with counter-arguments. After all, that's part of questioning your assumptions. I would have had to postpone such deep thinking had I decided to do the four-state challenge. This macho challenge involves walking on four states in 24 hours. For a Sobo like myself, that meant starting near the Pennsylvania border, the first state, plowing through 33 miles of trail in Maryland, the second state, blazing over the Potomac River and through Harper's Ferry into West Virginia, the third state, so that I could cross the Virginia border, the fourth state. Total mileage, 43 miles. Walking 43 miles in less than 24 hours is hard. The average thru-hiker walks 2 miles an hour when you factor in hills and occasional breaks. That means it would take almost 22 hours to hike 43 miles. Most don't want to take so much time, so they simply take fewer breaks to pick up the pace. Most Nobos start near the border of Virginia, leave before the sun rises, and finish around 3 a.m. At that point, they enter the fifth state, a state of utter delirium. This is the only part of the AT when you can pull off this testosterone-inspired feat because it's the only place where two adjacent states total less than 43 miles. The next shortest side-by-side states on the AT are Massachusetts and Connecticut. Crossing those two states on the AT means walking 140 miles. You can't cover that much terrain on foot in less than 24 hours, no matter how much caffeine you consume. I didn't do the four-state challenge for three reasons. First, the days were getting shorter, so that would have required more night hiking than the Nobos have to do when they attempt it. Since they attempt it around June or July, they enjoy 18 hours of daylight. By the time we got there in September, we only had 13 hours of daylight. Night hiking is slower than day hiking. Second, this trail had challenged me enough. Some Nobos, on the other hand, are looking for a challenge to prepare them for the hardest part of the trail, New England, whereas the Sobos had already completed it. And finally, my third reason for not doing the four-state challenge was I felt sorry for poor Maryland and West Virginia. These neglected states were a hazy memory for those attempting the four-state challenge. So many thru-hikers just blaze by these states without even giving them the honor of a campsite. I figured I'd pay attention to the fine state of Maryland and give it the respect it deserves by sleeping in the middle of it. During my leisurely stroll through Maryland, I thought of the best criticisms I could muster against the fourth principle. But you're discouraging risk-taking, some would say. The purpose of this chapter is not to discourage you from taking risks. The purpose is to demonstrate how learning from trail lore can help you achieve your goals in an efficient and pain-free manner. Life is about taking risks. If it's not clear yet, this book is about taking risks, for without risks, you're wasting your life. As we saw in the last chapter, you must take some risks to hike with passion. Of course, we will all slip and fall at times in our lives. However, there are plenty of obstacles we can avoid if we just learn from those who have gone before us. Some may argue that if you spend your life learning from trail lore, you'll never do anything. After all, you can always study a bit more and suffer from analysis paralysis. That's where the third principle comes into play. It's a principle about action, about hiking with passion. However, recklessly hiking with passion is dangerous because that route is filled with heartache, disappointment, and regret. Of course, a few get lucky, but most don't. As a result, they get discouraged and hit such economic hardship that they are forced to abandon their passion and get an unfulfilling job. So go ahead and take big risks, but just remember, when you ignore trail lore, you increase the odds of failure. When you learn from it, you increase your odds of success. But ignorance is bliss. Some successful people have said,
if I knew what it would take, I probably would have never done it.
In other words, had they learned from trail lore before pursuing their passion, they might have never pursued their passion. They would have been paralyzed by fear. This is a legitimate criticism because it's true. A few people who have reached the top of their profession might not have pursued their passion if they really knew the odds and the challenges before them. However, for every person who fits that profile, there are far more who did research, had a plan, and executed. Although they probably had to alter their plan, they avoided many mistakes just in their initial planning process. A carefully researched plan, based on the lessons from trail lore, is better than no plan. Obviously, no one can plan perfectly. After all, how many people on their deathbed would tell you that their life turned out exactly like they thought it would? Okay, maybe Nostradamus could have said so. Although ignorance may be bliss, it does not help you improve your odds of success. On the contrary, ignorance hampers your decision-making and makes it more likely that you will fail. Look at the history of the successful individuals and ask yourself how many were ignorant of their area of expertise before they embarked in it. Surely some were, but most weren't. Go with the odds and don't be ignorant of trail lore. But I'm unique, you might say. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "All life is an experiment." Similarly, you might think that since life is just one long experiment, that there is something unique about your experiment, or that life is just a bunch of random events that you have no control of. Let's analyze this counterargument. When I'm feeling pretty special, I like to remind myself, "Francis, you're unique, just like everyone else." If you had good parents, you probably were told that you are unique. It's a good way to build self-esteem and realize that you are important. This is good for kids and adults too. However, we take that logic to the next level when some of us believe that we're so special and unique that there's no point in learning from trail lore since we're so incredibly different from everyone who preceded us. But that's rarely the case. Any student of history can show you that both as a society and as individuals, we repeat history. For example, on a society level, as Paul Kennedy documented in his well-researched book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, there are common ways that empires collapse. We Americans would like to think we're special and different from these other empires, but it's certain that at some point we will repeat the same errors of the empires before us and that our reign at the top will not last forever. Similarly, on an individual level, Stephen Covey and others have shown the common good habits that successful individuals share. I may be unique, but if I repeat those common habits, I will probably be successful. Nobody has written a self-hamper book about how to be a loser, but I'm sure that there are principles on how to do that. No matter how unique you are, if you follow those principles, you too can be a complete loser. Although we believe we can beat the odds and break history's pattern, it rarely happens. We are unique, but principles that ensure our success do not change. But I love spontaneity, you say. Some worry that if you always focus on learning from trail lore, you'll never enjoy spontaneity. The key is that there is a difference between being spontaneous about major trails versus minor trails. It's rare that there's an advantage of learning from trail lore before getting involved in a minor trail. For example, if a friend invites you to learn how to ski, there's no point in trying to figure out how the professionals learned. Enjoy the spontaneity of the event and break a leg like everyone else. If, on the other hand, you hope to become a professional skier, then it's time to research trail lore and see how others got to the top of that profession. Therefore, the fourth principle doesn't kill spontaneity. There are some free spirits who embark on long-term journeys on a whim. After all, many famous actors drove out to Hollywood hoping to hit the big time. The AT certainly has its share of such free spirits. Indeed, many of my friends and coworkers thought I was a free spirit for just quitting my job to hike the AT. There's something romantic about just throwing caution to the wind and going off on an adventure sight unseen. It's similar to getting married to someone you just met a week ago. But that strategy rarely works, especially if you're marrying J-Lo. However, the road of pursuing your passion or any long-term objective is hard enough as it is, even with meticulous planning and research. The path of the AT didn't suddenly become easy just because I spent months researching it. Reading and planning didn't flatten any mountains or make the mosquitoes go away. It still was one hard and challenging trail. I just did not want to make it any harder than it needed to be. Other hikers who chose to wing it nearly always fell short. They ended up repeating the same errors and suffering from the same frustrations as thousands of hopeful hikers ran into before them. Party House, the fellow we met at the beginning of this chapter who decided to hike the AT on a whim, never made it to Georgia. In short, spontaneity is great for short-term events, but for the few decisions that really matter, learn from trail lore. But can't you overdo following this principle? Yes. If you scored extremely high on the trail lore quiz earlier in this chapter, then you might be overly zealous in following this principle. Those who meticulously plan every minutia of most of their lives need to relax. For example, one Sobo from New Jersey named Paradise, after a Jack Kerouac character, had not only planned every food drop, but could predict exactly to the hour where he would be. At 2 p.m. on September 22nd, I will be eating pasta with beans in Tennessee, Paradise assured me. I met Paradise later on, and he had thrown his detailed plan into a campfire. He was hiking far faster than he had originally planned. By Pennsylvania, he was already 4 days ahead of his schedule, throwing his timing completely off. Moreover, he quickly tired of the food he had painstakingly packed, so he bought new food along the way and left his prepackaged food behind. Eventually, he was so eager to see his girlfriend that he skipped hundreds of miles of trail so he could get to Georgia sooner. He certainly learned from trail lore before embarking on the AT, but probably overdid it. Clearly, it's better to overplan than to underplan. Most of us underplan and fail to learn from trail lore before embarking on an endeavor. As a result, we fall short of squeezing the most out of life. However, if all your close friends accuse you of overplanning, then you probably need to relax a bit on your trail lore research. Be more spontaneous, especially on the little activities in life, and most activities are little. Summary. We all make mistakes, however, only the great ones learn from them. Those who squeeze the most out of life learn from trail lore. They learn from both those who have done the right moves and the wrong ones. Most of those who successfully completed the AT had not just learned from the mistakes of those who were unable to complete it, but also had studied the common actions of those who did complete it. That combined knowledge gave them an inherent advantage over other hikers. It diminished their suffering, it increased their pleasure, and it let them enjoy the trail and their lives to the fullest. And they knew where all the cool spots were off the trail. Let's review the key points in this chapter. Humans are special because we share a vast amount of knowledge and history between ourselves. We should leverage that ability. To squeeze the most out of life, we must develop a strategy to avoid costly mistakes. To learn from trail lore, do not assume anything. Have an open mind. Research multiple sources and periodically re-question your beliefs and conclusions. Use trail lore to plot your path to your goal. And finally, conquer your fears by following this principle so you can create trail lore. As I observed in the last chapter, our time in this planet is short and precious. Our conscious hours are less than we realize, and it's clear why life blazes by for most people. The worst part is that we have no idea when we are going to die. Nevertheless, many people live their lives assuming that they will get the average 80 years. Math says that half of us won't make it that far. Because we have so little time allotted to us, to truly optimize our life, we must make every moment count. We should strive to minimize the number of painful and time-consuming errors that millions have done before us. The more we learn from trail lore, the less likely we will repeat mistakes, and the more we will get out of life. Therefore, deeply research any important decision before you make it by surfing the internet, talking with experts, and reading voraciously. As Groucho Marx said, "I find television very educating. Every time someone turns on the set, I go into the other room and read a book." Pennsylvania isn't as bad as I made it out to be. Yes, there were a lot of rocks, but I got used to them. In fact, Lisa loved Pennsylvania because the pastoral vistas of the Amish farms reminded her of growing up in the agricultural valley of Central California. She deeply inhaled the comforting smells of the freshly tilled earth. She felt at home. Although it was hot, the oppressive summer heat wave was gone, and the diabolic trails of New Hampshire and Maine were literally 1,000 miles away. Indeed, after we crossed the Susquehanna River and neared the southern end of Pennsylvania, we reached the emotional halfway point of our odyssey. We sat under the halfway marker that said we had hiked 1,069 miles. The marker is more symbolic than precise. Every year, the AT evolves slightly as sections are rerouted for a variety of reasons. In our year, for example, the true halfway point would have been 1,083 miles, but what's 14 miles between friends? It had taken us 2 months to walk this far. The trek had already taught me 4 valuable lessons. I had learned that the purpose of life was to enjoy it, that I should live below my means, that I should pursue my passion, and that I should learn from history. I knew these lessons would stay with me for the rest of my days. I wasn't sure what else I would learn during the second half of my pilgrimage. However, I couldn't imagine that the AT had finished teaching me her lessons. I rose eagerly in anticipation and continued hiking south.